You can keep talking.
Oh, okay.
But I gotta go.
Okay, so anyway, you've got these two bishops by the name leaders, I suppose you could call them bishops, of the two different factions. According to the Nazareans, they kicked out the Paulines. And that is evidently what happened, because the Nazareans stayed in Ephesus. They produced the Gospel of John and three letters written by Bishop John. The Nazareans in Ephesus produced four of the books of the Bible, and what they are is sticking it to the Paulines. The Gospel according to John actually has two endings. It looks like they were probably writing the Gospel of John before the breakup happened. And so there's a first ending, which has Jesus resurrecting and being seen by disciples and stuff. And it's an ending. But oddly enough, then there's another chapter. Somebody decided that ending wasn't good enough. So they added another ending that went into detail of things that happened in Galilee after Jesus and some of the disciples Jesus fled to Galilee, because there was a manhunt going on. And of course, he had to lay low, because the Jewish authorities were really pissed that this guy they wanted dead disappeared. And the disciples were saying, he's alive. And I'm going to have to digress just a moment on that one. Christians and scholars alike they walk into the thing with their preconceived notions, and they read the story and don't follow the storyline. The storyline of the crucifixion and who did what and why was that the Jewish establishment wanted Jesus dead. Okay, but because it was Passover, they weren't allowed to execute anybody, because it was too... Passover was Passover was this annual event where there were Jews from all over the world coming to Jerusalem, and not very many of them were fond of Roman rule. And so, Passover was this event that every year, Rome was scared shitless that there was going to be an insurrection. So Pilate, the governor, laid down the law and says, you guys are semi-autonomous. Semi-autonomy was actually fairly common in the empire.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't like Rome ruled everything directly. They tended to rule through puppet governments, so yet the puppet government can handle local matters according to their own rules, as long as they didn't do anything that pissed off Rome.
Yeah.
And yet that's how puppet governments work. So anyway, there was this rule, and that is during Passover, the Jewish parliament, the Sanhedrin, had no authority to execute anyone, because during Passover that was just Rome wisely didn't trust the Sanhedrin with that kind of authority during. During Passover. So anyway, they bring Jesus to Pilate, and they say, sir. We want you to execute this guy. He's a blasphemer. Well, excuse Pilate's thinking, excuse me? He's a blasphemer? Yeah. I ought to shake the man's hand. Really pissed. Yeah. What the hell are you guys doing? Yeah. I'm a busy guy, you know. I'm trying to keep order during Passover. You guys are wasting my time. Bring this guy to me. Pilate obviously has no idea who this Jesus is. You want me to execute a guy for blasphemy? That's the law against blasphemy. So he's going to jerk him around. He's pissed. He's going to jerk him around. He says, blasphemy? Execute him according to your law. And they said, but sir, we're not allowed to. It's Passover. So anyway, then they say, oh, that's right. He wasn't a blasphemer. He was an insurrectionist. Pilate knows. Pilate knows they're lying to him. If the guy was an insurrectionist, they wouldn't have brought him to. Can you kill him for us? He's a blasphemer. He knows the game they're playing.
Yeah.
And he's really pissed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is Passover. He's got his hands full trying to manage this little city that's probably got a million people in it, most of whom don't live there.
Mm-hmm.
Anything can happen. And he's really pissed. Oh, okay, but just the same, if he's if they said he's an insurrectionist, okay, well, that's a charge serious enough that he's got to take the guy aside and talk with him a little bit. Find out what the hell's, what's. They say that you're claiming to be a Messiah, in other words, the King of the Jews. And of course, excuse me, people claim to be King of the Jews are insurrectionists. We kill them. Jesus tells him, I am a king. It's true, but my kingdom is not a kingdom of your world. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. So. If I was an insurrectionist, see, where are my troops?
Mm-hmm.
They arrested me, but didn't find any troops.
Mm-hmm.
There was this one lunatic by the name of Peter that he did have a sword and he took a whack at the slave of the high priest. Surrounded by Roman soldiers, right? He didn't take a whack at a Roman soldier. So anyway, there were crazy times, and Pilate figures out real quick. The man is not an insurrectionist. The first complaint that he was a blasphemer. Okay. He's obviously a religious nut job. He's not an insurrectionist, but at least now I know why they called him a blasphemer. He's a religious nut job. I don't give a shit about religious nut jobs. If I give a shit about religious nut jobs, I'd spend all day every day dealing with religious nut jobs instead of governor business, right? It was a day and time where trying to deal with religious nut jobs would have been like whack-a-mole.
Mm-hmm.
Whack one and two more pop up.
Yeah.
The real concern is insurrectionists, right?
Yeah.
Pilate decides he's going to have some fun. The ruling council brought this guy to Pilate. Now Pilate's stuck with him. What's he going to do? He didn't give a shit about Jesus one way or another. But he's a Roman governor, right? Not a nice guy. As a matter of fact, he was so ruthless that eventually Caesar removed him from the job because he was too ruthless. Okay, you had to be pretty ruthless to get removed from the governorship. For the crime of ruthlessness. But to Pilate's credit, that's what it took to govern. Jewish Palestine.
Yeah.
He held the job of governor longer than anybody else did. So anyway, he's got this Jesus that they brought to him, and it said that he claimed to be the king of the Jews. So anyway, Pilate decided he's going to get even. He's going to have some fun. They said he claimed to be a king of the Jews. I said, by golly, I interviewed him, and by golly, he is a king of the Jews. So, yep. Takes his own ceremonial robe and puts it on Jesus. And then the crown of thorns, the whole thing. Hail, King of the Jews!
Yeah.
And they proceed to beat the living tarnation out of him. He's using Jesus to make an absolute mockery of the ruling council, this crap they had tried to pull on him. Friday morning, they decide to Pilate decides to crucify him. And so he's up there with a couple other guys who were insurrectionists. This Jesus, who was not an insurrection, not an insurrectionist, but the celebrated king of the Jews, who had been flogged within an inch of his life, but was still enough in one piece to be strung up on a cross, put him in the middle of the three.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the whole thing was for the purpose of insulting the ruling council for the shit they had pulled on him. And then he had a sign put on the cross that says, Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews, and had it in three languages. Latin, Greek, and Aramaic.
Oh.
But the ruling council knew exactly what he had done to them. They went to him and complained. They said, you wrote it wrong. You should have written, he claimed to be the king of the Jews. Pilate says, it's my sign. Don't tell me how to write my sign. I say he's king of the Jews. You know, okay, so Pilate did not crucify Jesus for being an insurrectionist. Pilate crucified Jesus to piss off the ruling council. It didn't have anything to do with Rome one way or another. He was just pissed at this crap that they had pulled on him. Of course, in the process, it was a good warning to anybody who thought they really did want to be king of the Jews. But a funny thing happened. They did this like maybe 9 in the morning. But was throwing him up on the cross Friday. With crucifixions, you know, the idea was you were basically a human billboard, and you'd be up there probably several days, busy dying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It wasn't like we crucify now you're dead. No.
Mm-hmm.
You were a human billboard, and they wanted that billboard to stay up there a while. Pilate in his enthusiasm had miscalculated, and somebody came and told Pilate, sir, Sabbath begins at sundown. You can't have. You can't have people up there on the cross during the Sabbath. That's a clear cut affront to Jewish law.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, this is Passover. you got a problem here. It's got to be dealt with quick, because the sun is rapidly approaching the horizon. So the two insurrectionists, they break the legs of the insurrectionists. Breaking their legs. Now they can't stand up. They slump over. They can't breathe. And pretty soon they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, having both of your legs broken isn't really good for your health either. They come to Jesus. Jesus passed out. Some people think he's dead. Okay, but therein lies a lot of confusion. Because in the ancient world, there was no category for unconscious or in a coma. They didn't have that category. You were either awake, asleep, or dead.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what we call unconscious, they called dead. Because, they're not moving. You yell at them, wake up and smell the coffee. And nothing moves. You're dead. Okay, they also knew that if a person was dead, there was a very slight, there was a slight chance that they might come back to life. Just very rational, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
People weren't nearly as stupid back then as they are nowadays. okay, and the so-called resurrection of Jesus was not a unique event. In the Bible itself, there are approximately 8 resurrections. Every last one of them is credible. And at least one of them, there's a description of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Lazarus was in the tomb. Everybody said, told him about the tomb, man. He's rotting and stinking, right? That's dead. But Jesus has a hunch that he may be resurrected. So he says, open the tomb. So they open the tomb. Lo and behold, Lazarus is not rotting and stinking. He resurrected.
Mm-hmm.
If he had been rotting and stinking, he couldn't have resurrected. See, no brainer, right?
Right.
There's no such thing as somebody resurrecting after the head has been cut off. Another thing is, there's the 3-day rule. The sign of Jonah. Jesus says. The sign of Jonah. I'm going to be in the belly of the whale for 3 days. If you've been dead for 3 days, you're not going to resurrect. There's no ICU.
Mm-hmm.
There's no intravenous feeding. There's no putting you on the oxygen machine.
Mm-hmm.
If you've been dead for 3 days, you ain't going to resurrect. The Bible itself. The Bible itself explains all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but thanks to St. Paul, nobody wants to know. because according to St. Paul, it was a supernatural event and the only resurrection that ever happened in history. The unique event in all human history. Somebody resurrects. No. Didn't people resurrect? They even had rules of thumb. The rules of thumb? They're right there in the Bible. There had been a plot for Jesus to survive the crucifixion. The details the details of that plot are hazy. In terms of the things that happened up leading up to the crucifixion and during the crucifixion. But anyway, Pilate, being the governor, of course, knew some of the people that were in the ruling council, and other locally prominent people. As a governor, that's how it was. And there's a saying: politics makes strange bedfellows. Up at the top, there's almost always power sharing of one kind or another, because if you don't reach some kind of combination, then somebody has to die. There were a couple people who were members of the Sanhedrin who were actually disciples of Jesus. And were part of the plot. One of them was named Nicodemus. I've forgotten who the other one was. And so anyway, they go to Pilate and say, "Oh, sir, we were buddies of this guy. Will he give us permission to haul him down off the cross?" And we'll stick him in the family tomb. And Pilate says, "Yeah, okay." And so Nicodemus and apparently another friend or two hauls Jesus down from the cross, put him in the tomb. They not only put him in the tomb, but they have but they've got a donkey load of 100 pounds of myrrh and aloes. That was the best medicine. That was the best medicine there was for the kind of injuries that Jesus had suffered. It didn't have anything to do with embalming anybody. But they knew that Jesus was still alive, or shall we say, dead but capable, but still capable of resurrecting, being resurrected. They're in the tomb, patching him up as best they can, with myrrh and aloes, and bandages. The Bible describes the bandages. So anyhow, at this point, or very shortly thereafter, Pilate's evidently aware of the fact that Jesus may resurrect. Very likely Very likely Nicodemus or one of his friends dropped the hints. And, yeah, we know why you did this, you know. We don't like what you did to Jesus, but we know why you did it. You know, so, so, you know, so actually, we don't like those guys either. So anyway, Saturday morning, I think it was representative. I think it was representatives of the high priest. Show up at Pilate's place. But this is supposed to be the Sabbath, right? What the hell are they? What they're doing? Showing up at Pilate's place again. So imagine Pilate. Oh shit, not these fuckers again. I thought I was done with those guys. anyway, they tell Pilate, you know, there's this rumor that the disciples might steal the body, and then they'll say, the body will vanish, and then they'll be saying that he resurrected. That fraud would be worse than that shit about him claiming to be a king of the Jews. Okay, well, imagine what Pilate is thinking. It would be worse. It would be worse. Let's do it. So he tells him, okay, well, so anyway, so this, you know, the tomb needs to be guarded to stop that from happening. But Pilate says, well, I've got guards. Okay, so here's several guards. Him and him. They're at your disposal. Yeah, get to station in front of the tomb, and then go back home. You know, it's the Sabbath. So anyway, yeah, the station the guards at the tomb. And then they go home. Of course, then Sunday morning, the tomb is open and Jesus has disappeared. Okay, the Bible has several different versions of that story. But they're basically different ways of telling the same, different ways of telling what's basically the same story. But there's, the favorite Christian question is, Who rolled away the stone from the tomb? The women couldn't have done it. You know, the women came there at dawn on Sunday morning to perform burial ritual, because that was women's work.
Mm-hmm.
No, they didn't. They didn't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The whole question of who rolled away the stone is a nonsense question, as far as Paul didn't ask that question. Okay. But all Paul knew was is that he had visions of the risen Christ. So, to hear Paul tell it, when Jesus resurrected inside the tomb, he just kind of poof. Magic. Nobody has to roll away the stone for God, right?
Right.
So anyhow, the whole story of how Jesus escaped from the tomb is one that was not told by the disciples, or it doesn't come down to us through the disciples. Okay, but it was a really funny story among those who knew it. It was so funny that it became the stuff of urban legend in Jerusalem, and the author of the Gospel of Matthew tells us what that urban legend was. It's what I call the guards' story.
Oh.
Okay. In the Gospel of Matthew, the guards' story is not—it's not all collected in one spot. You know, there's this whole sequence of things, and guards. Yep, guards are part of the story here, and part of the story there, and part of the story there. And so, if you don't want to know how Jesus escaped from the tomb, well, then you can pretend you don't know. Okay, but if you just take the guards' story and pull that out of the text and put it all in one piece, then it's funny as hell. It's funny enough that when Matthew says it was the stuff of urban legend, and that's how he learned about it, but then you know why it was the stuff of urban legend. It's funny as hell. The vanishment of Jesus. It was big news in Jerusalem when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus' arrival in Jerusalem, it was one of those things, quite a few people knew about it. It was this drama that was being played out. You know, Jesus was trying to make it a big drama.
Mm-hmm.
but until then, most people probably had no idea who this Jesus was. Yeah. In particular, it's obvious, Pilate had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
No. He was just a Jewish religious nut. You know, as long as he wasn't an insurrectionist, Pilate didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what happened. The But Pilate gives his own guards to the to the representative. I think it was the high priest. Okay, now the pilot's guard work for Pilate, don't they? They don't work for the high priest.
Yeah.
Yeah. They should have known they'd been had right then and there, right? They should have said, "Wait a minute, Pilate, you're pulling a fast one on us here." But anyway, it goes over their head. The guards are there, and they go back home. The representative of the high priest go back home.
Mm-hmm.
What is the job of the guards? Is it to make sure Jesus doesn't escape, or is it to make sure that he does escape?
Obviously, to make sure he does escape.
The stone of the door was heavy enough that everybody seemed, the women couldn't have moved it. But we're talking Roman guards here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not just any old Roman guards, the personal guards of the governor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They.
They didn't skip like that.
These are guys that King Kong didn't want to face. During the middle of the night, they open it up, and there is a disciple who's called in the tradition the disciple that Jesus loved, and the Gospel of Mark makes it very clear just exactly what that praise meant. In the Garden of Gethsemane scene, but that's a separate story.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those stories that if you read it from the pulpit, all you have to do is watch the faces in the audience. Do they understand what you just said? Yes, they do. No. Of course, they have to deny it. But the look on their faces, they know exactly what's said. There's this disciple whose name we don't know, but by tradition, his name is John, causing more confusion, and maybe his name was John. The disciple whom Jesus loved was at the tomb, obviously helped Jesus get back up on his feet, in other words, resurrect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What does resurrect mean? It means to stand back up again.
Yeah.
And bandage him. and put some clothes on him. And so he exits before sunup. The women get there at sunrise, and they discover he's not there. And the disciple whom Jesus loves says, "Well, you're looking for Jesus the Nazarene. He's not here." Remember that a few days ago he said that that after all this is over, to regroup in Galilee. And of course, then we have the stories in the Bible, but not in the Gospel of Mark, of how they did regroup in Galilee. The Gospel of Mark even tells us, the Gospel of Luke even describes the route by which he took. He went through Samaria because Samaria was regarded as ceremonially unclean. And Samaritans were regarded as scumbag heretics by Jews, and they didn't like to go in Samaria. However, we know that Jesus had a much more favorable view of Samaritans, and so he fled through Samaria in order to escape the manhunt. The Gospel of Luke describes that for us. In detail. All the stuff in the Bible, and Christians pretend not to know it. So meanwhile, back to the guard story. At sunup, then the guards go to the priest's quarters, and they tell the priests sorry to tell you, I have to tell you these, tell you guys this, but he escaped. We were there in the middle of the night. There was this blinding flash, they didn't use the word unconscious, it knocked us unconscious, right? That's the way we interpret it now. They were like dead men. And when they came to, the stone had been rolled back, and the Jesus disappeared. Sorry to have to tell you guys that, but just figured you wanted to know. Wink, wink. So anyway, for the priests and the ruling council, this is a real aw shit moment.
Mm-hmm.
So they hastily convene. They probably didn't have a legal quorum, but at least they got a bunch of guys together and said, "Oh shit, what are we gonna do? We gotta keep this quiet." In the ruling council, consisted of basically, it was basically the Jewish parliament, the Sanhedrin, and the priestly establishment, which was responsible for the operation of the temple. Okay, and in terms of religion, they were actually two different things. The priestly establishment, they were arch conservatives. Because it was all about the temple worship. They didn't have synagogues. Because the synagogues was invented, the synagogue was invented in Babylon during the captivity when there was no temple. So the Sanhedrin was various Jewish sects, but primarily Pharisees, who were far and away the largest sect of Judaism at that time, whose origins were traceable to Babylon. Because that was where the synagogue was invented. The synagogue you could export any place, and so it was the religion. It was the religion of the diaspora, and they were called Pharisees because Babylon was part of the Persian Empire. The word means Persians. Okay, so the Pharisees believed in angels and the resurrection of the dead and the end of time and stuff like that, because that was folk religion that they appropriated from Zoroastrianism, which was the Persian religion. And it's called that to this day, Parsis. So, the guards, of course, knew this. They said an angel had knocked him dead. Okay, this immediately causes a division among those assembled, because the Sadducees, who are the priestly establishment, who don't believe in the Babylonian innovations. They're strictly the old Torah of Moses and nothing else. Okay, and then you have the members of the Sanhedrin who are mostly Pharisees, who do believe in angels and the resurrection of the dead. Sort of. It's folk religion. It's not found in the Hebrew scriptures, but it's folk religion. Yeah, it's a way of explaining things.
Yeah.
So there's this immediate controversy of wait a minute, we don't even believe in angels, we don't believe this. The Sadducees, we don't believe this story. There ain't no such thing as angels. And of course then there's the Pharisees. Who are saying, we do believe in angels, although we're not sure that we believe the story they're telling us. So they got to do something. So they finally agree. So here's what really happened. The stupid fuckers fell asleep. Okay, that's a capital offense under Roman law. If you're guarding something, you don't fall asleep, you're dead. When you're in the Roman army, there's no such thing as a second chance. You screw up once, you're dead. So anyway, they tell the guards, look, you guys are bullshitting us. You fell asleep. The disciples stole the body. So we all know that's what happened, right? Okay, but we don't want you blabbing it. So here's a sack of money. Yeah, we're paying you not to blab it. And if somehow word gets back to Pilate that you guys fell asleep on the job, we'll go talk to Pilate. We'll ask him to take it easy on you.
Good deal.
Okay. Well, think about all of that a minute. The ruling council is gonna tell Pilate how to discipline his own guards? I don't think so. Okay, so put it all together. The stuff of verbal legend, and now you know why. Yeah, it's an extremely controversial event. Yeah, so controversial that it launched to the career of one Saul of Tarsus, who was a latecomer to the manhunt. And he thought he could find Jesus in Damascus, which was a very logical location. That's another whole story that's funny as hell once you start thinking about it. And start asking questions about the details. Okay, but. The resurrection of Jesus was a huge event. The crucifixion. That was a really interesting event. But it's one of those one of the details that 2 weeks later nobody would have been talking about it. One of those things where, that whole thing was kind of weird.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody would have forgotten about it. Okay, but the resurrection is what put the whole, it's what put the whole thing on the map. And it's kept it there for 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part of the story that hasn't been told, but if you think about it, you can figure it out. The guards had this sack of money. Where did they go with it? Straight to Pilate. High fives all around.
Yeah.
the part that's not in the Bible is where they go back to Pilate and do the high fives, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but if you know, yeah, but all the rest of it's in there. If you can, yeah. If you can take that story to where they're walking out the door with a sack full of money, and you know how it all happened, well then, there's only one logical next step, and that is they go back to Pilate and they do that. Damn, we nailed them again. For being leaders, these guys are so stupid. okay, so back up to the little church controversy in Ephesus. You've got the Nazarenes. Whose own leaders several decades earlier had, when they figured out what Paul was up to, call him a false apostle, a fraud. And we know that because Paul himself says, Paul himself is really pissed that he's been being called a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And he insists, no, I'm a real apostle. I never met Jesus in the flesh. I was, like you guys did, but I had visions of the risen Christ. I mean, what more could you want, right? And attending him personally. And he gave me this gospel of the risen Christ. And we all know he did that because, I state explicitly that I didn't learn the gospel from you guys. No, I didn't learn it from any human being. Paul is very explicit about this.
Mm-hmm.
Yet he did not learn it from any human being, not from the real apostles. No, it was direct revelation from the risen Christ himself.
Mm-hmm.
And because that was Paul's personal experience, well, then it was all perfectly valid to him. But, gee, how much does it cost to have a vision of a God, and why should anybody else think it matters to them, right?
Right.
If you offered a dollar for everybody who's got a special message from God that they think everybody else want to hear, people would be lined up for miles asking for their dollar. Anyway, you got these two factions. The Nazarenes finally figured out, we can't get these guys straightened out. So they kick him out. And we know it was the Nazarenes who kicked the Paulines out because the Nazarenes are the ones who stayed in Ephesus.
Uh,
uh, uh, uh, uh, uh, Bishop John of the Pauline faction wound up going to the island of Patmos. It was a prison island. And, of course, according to religion tradition, excuse me, Christian tradition, that means, you know, oh, he was arrested for being a Christian, and the Romans put him in prison. No. It's just, we don't know why he was on Patmos. All we know is that he was in Ephesus. So the Nazarene faction evidently had this gospel of John already in the works, and more or less finished. And that only made the schism worse. So finally they broke up. And so the Nazarenes said, well, we really ought to put a boot print on their butt on the way out the door and write another ending that describes the things that Jesus did in Galilee. Very human type things. Just to stick it to them.
Yeah.
Because all of this is the stuff that they deny ever happened. And then you have the epistles, where Bishop John of the Nazarene faction calls them antichrists, which isn't referring to Christ, the God of the Pauline faction, although that's the way they would have read it, because to them the word Christ meant this God. But in Greek, the word Christ just means Messiah, which means the Anointed One. And the phrase the Anointed One can mean many different things. Christians like to say, "Oh, there's only one Messiah." No. There's several Messiahs in the Bible. No, King David was a Messiah. Described as a Messiah. That used that word to describe him. But then there was the more general meaning is the ritual for appointing someone to a sacred task was you put olive oil on their forehead, because olive oil that's what you put in a lamp for illumination. And of course, olive oil was also medicine for healing. So that's what all that was about. The epistles are rants against the Paulines, called antichrists, for denying Jesus in the flesh, which is exactly what Paulines do. I mean, read Paul's epistles. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, it's time for me to go grab a Bible, because by golly, we heard the other side of that story from the Paulines, and it's in the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation, theologically, it's Orthodox Pauline theology. It's not Nazarene at all. Okay. Yeah, let me grab my Word of God here.
It'll take me a minute to find it. It opened to Galatians 1. I'll give you this one. This is Paul. Now I want you to know, brothers, that the gospel preached by me is not of human origin. For I did not receive it from a human being, nor was I taught it, but it came through a revelation of Jesus Christ. And later he describes how he went to meet with the real apostles and kind of bullshitted him. Okay, so now Revelation. Revelation begins with letters to the churches, or messages to the churches in Asia Minor. To the angel of the church in Ephesus, write this: the one who holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks in the midst of the seven golden lampstands says this: I know your works, your labor, and your endurance, and that you cannot tolerate the wicked. You have tested those who call themselves apostles but are not, and discover that they are impostors. Moreover, Moreover, you have endurance and have suffered for my name, and you have not grown weary. Yet I hold this against you. You've lost the love that you had at first. Realize how far you've fallen. Repent and do the works you did at first. Otherwise, I will come to you and remove your lampstand from its place unless you repent. But you have this in your favor. You hate the works of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. Okay, now who are the Nicolaitans? There will be a note here. Okay, the scholars evidently don't really know who these Nicolaitans are. It's kind of funny. In the letters of Paul, Paul is bitching that the real apostles refuse to acknowledge him as an apostle. Okay, so now we're here on the other side of the story. You have tested those who call themselves apostles but are not, and discovered that they're imposters. all the stuff is in the Bible. You can read it, it's right there.
That's great.
And why is it I'm the only one that knows this stuff? I can partly answer that. The scholars. To them, it's its career, publish and perish. You want peer review.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, they're working with a hypothesis they want to prove.
Mm-hmm.
And the building on the work of other people, they have their favorite. Yeah, they have their favorite scholars who preceded them, etc. So it's it works like academia works. Okay, now as it turns out, you find yourself a good Christian apologist who really knows their stuff. They know what's in the Bible a lot better than most scholars do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes it so easy to prove, to get them to tip their hand what they know. It turns out, they don't believe that stuff any more than Richard Dawkins did. They know that that St. Paul's God, Jesus Christ, was a figment of his imagination, because they've read Paul's letters. And they know that the real apostles called him an imposter. I mean, it's one of the plainest things there is in the Bible. Obviously, if this Jesus Christ is God, who resurrected from the dead magically, and all the rest of that stuff, that came from St. Paul. Paul tells us it came from him, and he tells us it did not come from the apostles. They know this. They've read it. When you know that, how can you possibly believe in the Christian God? You can't. It doesn't necessarily mean you're an atheist. But in the case of Christian apologists, it means they're an atheist, because they claim they believe in the Christian God.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't say boo about any other God. That's my long-winded essay on the book of Revelation, how we got it, what it is. There's a part that I left out. At least I think I left out this time around. Apocalyptic literature was popular in those days. Revelation survived because of the apocalypses, at least that I have seen. It's just far and away the best. It is a superb piece of writing. It was written with tremendous insight into human nature, and historical processes. It is the work of a genius.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not run-of-the-mill stuff. So it's no wonder that people get sucked into it.
Yeah.
How much do they get sucked into it?
Yeah.
We have nearly 2,000 years of Christian history answering that question.
Mm-hmm.
Millions and millions and millions of people thinking that it's predicting the future in their lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, of that many, many millions of people who thought that's what it was, every last one of them was wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything in human history that has a worse track record than the Book of Revelation.
Yeah.
And then there was Harold Camping.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the famous radio preacher. What was it, Chris? A Christian Family Radio Network, I think it was called. I heard Harold Camping on there. You know, what was it? I think like maybe a couple hours every day. This sermon and call-in show and stuff. And the guy was really good at what he did. I understand why he's popular. And then he got this silly idea that he had deciphered the Book of Revelation and figured out when the end was going to happen. And I think it was like maybe May of that year. He named the date and time. So batten down the hatches. That's today. And of course, most of his listeners must have wondered. I'm not quite ready to batten down the hatches for the end of time yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's full of bullshit. We'll write it out. I don't think I'm going to turn him off quite yet.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the day came and went, and probably the only thing interesting happened on that day was someplace, somewhere, somebody's toilet clogged.
Yep.
And the world went on. Of course, Harold Camping had some explaining to do. Oh, I miscalculated. Well, gee, no shit. okay, but it's a calculation you shouldn't have done in the first place. Doing it wrong was the second offense, not the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Doing it at all was the first one. No, it's funny. I miscalculated it. Okay, but I'll get to work on this and figure it out again. So he comes up with a new calculation, and I think on that one, I think it was for a day in September. His listenership are saying to themselves, "My God, the guy didn't learn." I mean,
mm-hmm.
Even Christians know that predicting the end in your own lifetime out of the Book of Revelation has a track record of 100% failure.
Yeah.
Even Christians know that. the guy has obviously gone off the deep end, and then having failed instead of slapping himself on the forehead and saying, "Stupid me," he says, "Oh, I need to give it another try," and then he does. Revenue was falling into a deep hole. The appointed date in September came and went, and somebody unclogged their toilet, and life went on.
Uh-huh.
And there was a bit of a crisis. Nobody was willing to donate money to Christian Family Radio to hear Harold Camping anymore. I think he actually owned it. I could be mistaken on that detail. Okay, but it's a minimum. If he didn't own it, he was the show. So you could say that in a sense he owned it, even if he didn't literally own it, but I think he literally owned it. But at that point, they had this radio network and listenership that wasn't worth a dime if they kept Harold Camping behind the microphone. So they worked out a deal for him to retire or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm supposing they managed to keep it on the air. Maybe they changed the name of it. And I think Harold Camping himself, I think, died several months later. Okay, so that's just an example of revelation. It really is the work of a literary genius, written so well that a guy of the stature of Harold Camping, who above all should have known, don't go down that road, went down that road and crashed.
Mm-hmm.
And said, I'm going to do it again.
Yeah.
So that's a big revelation.
Thank you.
You're welcome.